Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295, but please hold your calls until we ask for them, because we have a fascinating guest this evening. His name is Richard Miniter, and he's written a book called Shadow War, The Untold Story of How Bush is Winning the War on Terror. Now, we had interviewed Mr. Miniter several times before on his book, Losing Bin Laden, which was really a very important part of the entire story. He pointed out in that book that on 11 separate occasions, why the Clinton administration had an opportunity to certainly take out Osama bin Laden, and time and again they snatched defeat out of the jaws of victory, as it were. And you're going to find that this book is equally fascinating. And Mr. Miniter, thank you so very much for being with us tonight, especially at this late hour back there on the East Coast.
Well, Dr. Stan, thanks for having me on. It's great to be back with you so soon.
Well, let's, of course, go into the background. Now, of course, you did a lot of traveling. You traveled all over the world talking to people to put this book together. And one of the amazing stories that I thought it was, anyway, was when you went into Darfur and you really went out on your own into sort of a no-man's land in this area where there's so much violence, and now they're telling us that 70,000 people have been slaughtered there. And you have these warlords, Arab warlords. Apparently they're black, but they're black Arabs and Muslim, and they're going around killing people and a totally state of lawlessness. And would you like to tell that story? Because you really wanted to know, is this Al-Qaeda? What's really going on? What's the motivation for all this killing?
That's right. I mean, in Africa, there are lots of motivations for killing. In Darfur, I think it's largely tribal. I went out to see a warlord. I think I'm still the only reporter to go and interview one of the Janjaweed, one of the real villains in Darfur, those responsible for great massacres. Janjaweed is a play on words in Arabic. The jinn sound in Janjaweed refers to demon, as in demon on horseback, literally translated. But it's a play on words because jinn is also jinn 3, in English G3, referring to the French assault rifle. They use brand new French-made assault rifles. Now, usually in African civil wars, you see the weapons. There's a cheap Chinese-made AK-47s with the folding stock. But in this case, these are brand new weapons right out of a packing grease being deployed. That's unusual. That caught my attention. And what also caught my attention was the brand new pickup trucks of the rebels and the brand new satellite phones. Now, to maintain a satellite phone in Darfur, you're spending $6,000 to $10,000 a month. That is a fortune. Per capita income in Sudan is $400 a year. Clearly, an outside power is at work. So I kept pressing Sudanese intelligence, the Chadians, the Algerians, and others to tell me what they knew. Here's what they said. They believed that Al-Qaeda was behind funding the rebel movement in Darfur. Al-Qaeda was behind the misery. So I went out into the hills in North Darfur when my fixer had a cousin who had a friend. That's the way it is in that part of the world. Who was part of the Janjaweed. I went and met with him. His name was Mr. Carver. He said he hated all authority. He hated all government. He made war on everyone. And he said that he wanted economic progress for his people. And I thought this was, I don't know how to say it politely, a lie. Because, in fact, the amount of economic development poured in Darfur in the last 10 years by the Sudanese government was the largest amount of funding that region had received since the British left in 1955. The British left a sterling infrastructure. Of course, it degraded and decayed, but they did. In the last 10 years, the Sudanese government is pouring a lot of money. And he said, his response to this was, not in my village.
Well, now, of course, so where were they getting the money then for their brand new AK-47s and for their satellite phones and elsewhere? Was it simply plunder or what?
No, it was money from Al-Qaeda.
So it was Al-Qaeda money then that was feeding into that area. Now, why would Al-Qaeda be interested in that sort of godforsaken part of the world? It's just barren nothingness.
Well, they're interested in lots of godforsaken parts of the world. When I interviewed one of these Al-Qaeda fighters who was captured in an old British-built prison being held by the Sudanese, he said, "Don't you believe we fight for God?" And I said, "I think if you're fighting for terrorism, you're dialing the wrong number."
I'm sure he didn't appreciate that. But anyway,
He threatened to kill me, and I said, he's going to send a suicide bomber to my house, and I gave him my address. Because you can never show fear and weakness with these people. And if you show a certain toughness, then they have respect for you. And then they will really talk to you.
Well,
And I was really trying to understand where they were coming from, Dr. Stan. I was trying to get them to tell me what they were thinking. And in fact, they liked chaos and disorder, and so does Al-Qaeda. They're into chaos and order and disorder, just like in Afghanistan. They will set up a new base. They were looking desperately for a new Afghanistan. The United States, the Bush administration, has kept them on the run. And they badly need a place where there is no order, no central authority, where they can set up their own training camps and their own mini-state. And they hope to do that in the vast region of Darfur.
And I think that was really the most significant part one of the most significant parts of your whole story, at least that part of the story, was that Al-Qaeda hopes to use this area, this vast part of the northern Sahara, to establish this an area where they will be able to escape, because the Americans have done such an effective job of wiping out their centers of control all throughout the rest of the world.
Exactly right, Dr. Stan. I mean, look, we've killed and captured more than 3,000 Al-Qaeda fighters since 9/11 in 102 different countries. And in many of those countries are North African countries. Places the papers never write about. But we carried out covert operations in Chad, Mali, Niger, Algeria, even in Morocco. And in the sand of the Sahara, we pursued them. The Bush administration has pursued the enemies of freedom to the depths of the sea and to the ends of the earth. And it's really an astonishing thing to behold. When I started out to write this book, and I know I told you this before, but I think I should remind your audience, I didn't anticipate that this would be a series of Bush successes. I thought I was going to write a critical book, very similar to the book I wrote about Clinton and Bin Laden, called Losing Bin Laden.
Hold that thought for just a moment while we bring our other stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Richard Miniter, his book, Shadow War, and Richard, of course, has been telling us about having gone into the Sahara, the vast expanse of almost nothingness there, that you'll find from the western Sudan and then into that area adjacent to it. And of course, what he found was that there was Al-Qaeda there. Al-Qaeda was trying to actually establish another base someplace where, it was so vast we would have a hard time tracking them down, because, as Richard comments, Bush administration had done a magnificent job of tracking down the Al-Qaeda fighters all throughout the world, would captured or killed two-thirds of their leadership, killed about 3,000 of the Al-Qaeda, and just crippled their operation all throughout the world. So here in the area of Darfur and the adjacent areas, they're trying to establish a new base. Now, one of the most interesting parts of your book was your story of Osama bin Laden. And we hear over and over again, Osama bin Laden is hiding in a cave in Pakistan. But the information you were able to get from intelligence officers was really quite different. Would you like to tell that story?
Oh, happily tell the story, Dr. Chen. Look, there are two sources inside Iranian intelligence. One of whom is able to give his name because he's sensed the fact that it's the West. The other of whom I have to give a pseudonym to, which is Chupan, which means shepherd in Farsi. That's the language of Iran. And these two sources independently say that they saw bin Laden in the Iranian village of Najmabad on October 23rd, 2003. They saw him face to face. And they had met him before, so they knew exactly who he was. They said that he changed his appearance somewhat. He changed his beard. He changed his dress. Trying to pass himself off as a Shia cleric, a holy man in Iran. And that Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri was with him, and he'd received medical treatment in the country of Iran. And here's the most chilling part, Dr. Stan. They has forged an alliance with Iran. Al-Qaeda and Iran are working together. Now, if these two sources are correct, this is a nightmare scenario. Iran is developing an atomic device. According to the Israelis, they might be 6 months away from having a working atomic device. CIA says they're a year away. Either way, it's a nightmare scenario. Then you add to that that they've already deployed the Shabab 3 missile, which can strike U.S. targets throughout the Middle East and the nation of Israel. And they're working on the Shabab 4, which will strike U.S. bases and American allies in Europe. Shabab 5 will be intercontinental. We already know that Iran is the largest sponsor of international terrorism in the world, bar none. And now they're working with Al-Qaeda. This is the perfect storm of terrorism, the perfect center of evil, the locus of tragedy in the modern world.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, we have other sources of information that are basically, and we've been saying this for some time, that there was and has been a working relationship between Al-Qaeda and Iran that has been very carefully covered up by our government for some reason. And in fact, isn't one of Osama bin Laden's sons living there? And actually, a number of Al-Qaeda leaders, they've even openly admitted that, haven't they?
You're absolutely right, Dr. Stan. In fact, Iranian state television has said that Saad bin Laden, the 24-year-old son of Osama bin Laden, his oldest son, in fact, is resident in Iran. They've also said that more than 500 Al-Qaeda fighters are resident in their country. The Saudis have, very humbly petitioned to question these people and been denied. The United States, the Europeans, have asked in the name of peace to question these Al-Qaeda people who are supposedly under arrest in Iran and been denied. And satellite photos have revealed these people continue to make satellite phone calls to direct terror attacks. They have moved about in the country in the company of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
So there has to be then with the full support and knowledge of the high officials in the Iranian government.
Dr. Stan, Iran is a terrible dictatorship. A sparrow does not fall without the mullah's knowing. They are in complete control. And they have, therefore, complete responsibility for the evil forces that move within their country.
Well, I think the most frightening part of this whole scenario is not even the fact that there's a relationship between Al-Qaeda and the Iranian government, but the Iranians are moving very rapidly towards production of nuclear weapons, and Israel cannot allow that to happen. And I think it was not simply by chance that America apparently is giving bunker buster bombs to Iran. Now, these are bombs that, of course, go down to
Israel.
Underground facilities. Have you gone into that at all, the implications of that?
Well, when I was in Israel a few weeks ago, Dr. Stan, I went to see some guys at the Ministry of Defense. I don't want to say their names on the air.
Okay.
But they are both Iranian-born. They are both had served in the Iranian army, but they're Jews. And they're now very high-ranking in the Ministry of Defense in Tel Aviv. They are working on a plan which to topple the mullahs, not with an airstrike, not with a ground invasion with U.S. forces, but a covert plan, which is very sophisticated. The Israelis know they're playing against time, and they're deadly serious about it.
And they've either got to topple the Iranian government or attack them, one or the other. They have those two choices. They cannot let Iran get the nuclear weapons.
But remember, an airstrike will not work because it's very simple. There are too many targets. There are at least four, and the Israelis say as many as seven, parallel WMD programs. That means we have at least seven sets of sites. The Israeli Air Force simply doesn't have enough planes to strike all these sites, many of which, like the site of Bashir, is a hardened facility. It was designed to survive an airstrike. The Arabs learn, just like all the enemies of freedom learn, from past encounters. They know that the 1981 strike on the Iraqi atomic reactor at the Oserac, not to make themselves vulnerable, but to first facilities, to have many different buildings. And here's another problem. If the Israelis want to strike, they need to refuel. There's only one place in the Arab world for them to refuel, and that is U.S. air bases, H-1, H-2, and H-3 in Iraq. That implies American complicity. At that point, President Bush has to decide to either join them or help them. And their strike will be considered a U.S. strike. So if the Israelis strike, it would be tantamount to declaring war on America.
I share your concerns. I think we're sitting on a powder keg over there, and it's the fuse is already burning. And I think the American people are going blithely on their way without any realization of what's really going on in the world.
But I think the American people are smarter than the American elites. I think the American people realize that Iran has been their enemy since 1979, since 52 American hostages were held for 444 days, since the weakness and vacillation of Jimmy Carter created an opening in the Muslim world. It gave them perception, a window on American weakness, which has emboldened the worst elements of the worst regime in the Middle East.
Well, let's get on into some of your other amazing stories that you have. You tell the story of the Al-Qaeda admiral. Now, I think most Americans have never heard that Al-Qaeda actually had a shipping fleet. Would you like to tell that story?
I would be happy to tell the story, Dr. Chan. Look, there was a guy, and I'll tell you his real name. His real name is Abdul Fatim al-Mashiri. He was called by Saudi intelligence as the Prince of the Sea, also the Al-Qaeda admiral. He had a command of a fleet of 15 cargo vessels. And the owners of this fleet were the same people who owned the Karen A. Remember, they were caught by Iran shipping weapons to the Palestinians and intercepted by the Israeli Navy. Same fleet. And this fleet, the Al-Qaeda admiral was responsible for shipping the bomb-making materials that led to the 1998 embassy bombings, August 7, 1998, that killed 224 Africans in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, including 12 American diplomats. He was also responsible, he was the mastermind, in fact, of the attack on the USS Cole, which on October 12, 2000, killed or injured 44 American sailors, and the Clinton administration did nothing. We captured him on the island of Qusair in the Persian Gulf. He's transferred out of U.S. custody to Saudi custody. Why we send him to the Saudis? Because they have means of extracting information, which is, let's say, a little tougher than what we had at Guantanamo Bay or Abu Ghraib. They had means of eliciting information that is not sanctioned under U.S. law. But that information is vital to uncovering cells and thwarting plots. You might remember, on a Yemen highway, a flaming car of wreckage, and inside the bodies of five Al-Qaeda figures. One of them was a man named Al-Harafi. Al-Harafi was al-Mashiri's deputy head of naval operations for Al-Qaeda. After we had him in custody, we found out where Al-Harafi was. A Predator aircraft found him cruising the highways with a carload of terrorists, and it dispatched a single Hellfire missile following the order of a CIA station chief in Djibouti on the Red Sea of Africa, 160 miles away.
No, I think that the audience really understands the sophisticated technology that we have, and these are certainly drones, the Predator are drones, but they have, of course, first of all, weapons. They have a Hellfire missile on them, and then they have the ability to take video pictures so that somebody can sit 160 miles away, or they can sit over there in Florida, for that matter, wherever the headquarters is, and they can actually see exactly what the Predator plane is viewing, and then they can order the firing, and they're able to actually track people down really any place in the world with those incredible weapons. In fact, we had them before 9-1-1, but nothing was done to, even though we were watching bin Laden regularly with those weapons, and I think we could have taken them out. They just didn't bother to arm them until after 9-1-1. And wasn't it within a couple of months of 9-1-1 we already had the Hellfire missiles on them?
Absolutely right. But what matters is the character of the man in the Oval Office. Is he willing to fight? Is he determined to win? Or is he hesitant and calculating and cautious? And that's the choice, and that's the difference between Clinton and Bush. That's the question.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to take a break here. And then, of course, when we get back, why, of course, we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. This is a fascinating book because, really, Richard has been all over the world talking to people in intelligence, talking to people at Al-Qaeda, gathering information and putting it all together in his latest book, Shadow War, The Untold Story of How Bush is Winning the War on Terror. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening, Richard Miniter. We're talking about the amazing technology we have. Now, my understanding was, wasn't it just in December of 2001, what is that, two months after the 911 attack, why we were able to take out another one of the Al-Qaeda people with a Predator missile? I think Richard thought that we went to a break as we did with our other program, but Richard Miniter, are you there? Well, I guess I'm going to have to talk until Richard comes back on the line.
I am back on the line.
Okay, fine. No, we actually talk through the breaks on this program. Each program, you know, I do 5 hours a day, and almost every one of them has different breaks, and it gets a little confusing. But no, we have to talk through these breaks. Anyway,
I'm so sorry about that. No, that's
all right. I was saying
I'm sitting here with my parents. I've just seen for a little while, and. So sorry about that.
Oh, that's all right. You give them my best and tell them I appreciate them allowing you to be on with us here. Anyway, you were talking about the fact that in your book you were saying that I think it was December of 2001 that we tracked down one of the Al-Qaeda leaders with a Predator plane and he went to that great paradise in the sky with 72 virgins. What was that story all about?
That's November 2001.
Was that November?
Outside the city of Kabul, Afghanistan, the capital, a Predator plane found the head of Al-Qaeda's military wing. His name was Mohammed Atef, and he had signed on every serious attack on Americans from 1996 to 9/11. And we found him, we positively identified him. Langley looked at the video from the Predator, compared it against their database of photos, and they gave the order. A single Hellfire missile found him and killed him. Later, U.S. Special Forces went in and took DNA samples of the wreckage and confirmed that Mohammed Atef was dead.
Now, I think this is the most amazing technology. First of all, that we're able to identify these people from Predator planes, and this is just a month after 9/11, after the attack on America. These Predators are already up and functioning effectively. Well, would you like to tell us a little bit about the Mekki? I think that's the title. The Mekki plot, and they thought this was going to be a serious attack on America. That was an amazing story.
Well, I'm glad you liked it, Dr. Stan. This is a 2002 plot to assassinate President Bush. In August 2002, CIA, FBI, and Homeland Security were scrambling. Their intelligence was telling them from a CIA source codenamed M that a group of former Sudanese Air Force pilots had gathered in Greensboro, North Carolina, and their plan was to pack a small plane with bombs and fly it into the west wing of the White House while President Bush was there on the one-year anniversary of 9/11 and kill the President of the United States. This is in Chapter 3 of Shadow War. Now, as it unfolded, and I don't want to ruin it for the reader, there are a number of reverses. It's a great close study of how intelligence really works from multiple perspectives. But let's just say it revealed a massive intelligence failure. It revealed the weakness and stupidity of the CIA in one way. But it was also, because the Bush people were smart, a massive intelligence success, which enabled us to carry out 7 covert operations jointly with the Sudanese in Somalia that led to the capture of high-ranking Al-Qaeda in Mogadishu and other places in Somalia. We constantly kept these people on the run. We have been relentless. We have been unforgiving. And, you know, most importantly, Dr. Stan, we've been unbureaucratic. We did not subject these people to the pleasant miseries of lawyers. We just got on with it, as the British would say. We wanted these people to accomplish their goals. And that's what's necessary to win the war on terror. What concerns me about Senator Kerry, as honorable man as he might be, is that he would subject these people to the kind of petty regulation, the kind of small-minded rules that keep anyone from accomplishing anything meaningful in this life on Earth.
All right, fine. Well, of course, now we want to get to the Mekki plot, but maybe we could go ahead and talk to Howard, who's calling from San Antonio. Howard, did you have a quick question here?
Yeah. Hey, Dr. Stan, and your guest. I mean, your guest is saying we're winning the war on terror. Dr. Stan, I don't know if you know about the simulated nuclear device, suitcase nuke, that was brought over from the Mexican border and the Arizona border. and put into a back of a pickup truck, drove to Tulsa, Oklahoma, Tucson, Arizona, then from there, went, I think, to Phoenix, to the federal building, and took it all the way up the steps in a backpack.
Now, this was a simulator. It wasn't really a bomber.
Recall it from something called the Nogales Project.
Okay, fine. And so,
happened was they did it twice.
Okay, fine. Well, let's get what you're saying is that they were able to bring weapons across the border and take them right to Washington, D.C.
No. They took them to Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay. All right, well, let's get Richard's response to that. Richard, what would you say to Howard, who's saying that we seem to have a very porous border?
I've looked at this extensively. And the problem with suitcase bombs is it's true, the Soviet Union did develop several of them, two or three. But they weigh 680 pounds apiece. So this is not carry-on luggage. How about you, Dr. Stan? I mean, I'm not a weightlifter. 680 pounds in one hand in a suitcase is a lot for me. Because of all the shielding and, of course, the weight of the device inside, it's maybe it's the size of a suitcase. It can fit in a suitcase, but it is not a suitcase. Let's just say when you're passing the airport security, and they're used to taking a 30 or 40 ton object through the metal detector, and suddenly they get this 680 pound device, it may set off a few alarms. That, combined with the fact that when they X-ray it, you will see the telltale signs of an atomic device.
But, of course,
Howard's point is the Nogales Project.
Yeah, and not only that...
Well, Richard, go ahead and...
Let me see what Howard has to say.
Go ahead, Howard.
I want to really answer his question, not half-heartedly.
Okay, Richard.
My question is, how did that one suspected female terrorist end up in New York City, and they caught her, and then they find out that she crossed over from Mexico into Texas, and got all the way to New York?
Now, was she a real terrorist or simulated terrorist?
No. She was a suspected terrorist, and they arrested her.
Okay, fine.
I forgot what her name was.
Tell me something different then. Because the Nogales Project was an attempt by Border Patrol to have a simulated terrorist attack where everybody knew the routing, and still they didn't catch it. And that showed a real hole in border security. But the fact is that border security has learned from these kinds of things.
But we don't have enough.
We don't have enough. That's true.
Look,
I got to tell you where I'm coming from politically. I'm not a registered Republican or Democrat, but I'll tell you this. I do believe that immigration is largely good, but welfare for immigrants is bad. I do think that we need to have greater border security because we know that Al-Qaeda elements, and not just Al-Qaeda, but Chechen terrorists and others, want to penetrate the Mexican border into the United States.
In Canada.
Canada is a different situation. The Canadians actively allow terrorists in their country. The real question in American politics about our homeland security is why the Canadians are not on our side. Everyone complains about the French. But Ahmed Rassam wanted to blow up Los Angeles International Airport in 1999. It was caught by a sharp-eyed border agent in Washington State. The Canadians have been a continuous source of Al-Qaeda activists trying to penetrate our northern border. Everyone complains about Mexico, and they say dire things about Mexican culture. But I'll tell you this. The Mexicans are trying harder than the Canadians. We have feckless allies and friends to the north. That's something we really need to consider in the next administration, whoever's running it.
Okay, fine. Thanks so much for calling, Howard.
We'll
talk more about it later.
All righty.
Okay, and of course, our guest this evening is Richard Miniter. We're talking about his book entitled Shadow War. Of course, it goes into the background of the untold story of how Bush is winning the war on terror. And certainly we have done an excellent job of tracking down two-thirds of the Al-Qaeda leadership and, of course, either killing or capturing them. And Al-Qaeda throughout the world is pretty much in disarray. And it's still, we'll not get into the background of Iraq. We'll be back in just a moment or two with our special guest right here at Radio Liberty.
Hey, Dr. Stan, are we still on the air?
Well, we're going to be back in just a moment.
Okay. I got a great bounce.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Richard Miniter. We're talking about his book, The Shadow War, and, of course, the fascinating stories that he tells as he's traveled throughout the world talking to people. And, of course, you had the opportunity to spend a fair amount of time going and talking with these people in the Sudan, but I think this whole story of the Miki plot really got into a total inadequacy on the part of certain people within the CIA, actually paying people for reports, and of course then people get paid for reports, they write reports, and maybe they have absolutely no basis for them, but that information gets into the cycle and creates all sorts of problems. So would you like to sort of develop on that idea?
You know, I think that thing you've hit on a very good point. This is one of the major problems with the CIA, and it's a problem that persists today. I know the Bush people are trying to correct it, but the CIA culture is resistant. In the case of Sudan, they're paying $400 a report. The per capita income in Sudan for a year is $400.
Now, this is the CIA is paying $400.
For one report.
Right.
For one page of typewritten information. The temptation for desperately poor people, when the per capita income in a year is $400 and the price per report is $400, is to make something up or to exaggerate. Now look, the per capita income for a family of three in the United States is $38,500. If I were to come to you and say, can you write one page on how your neighbors are starting to blow up the Pentagon, and I'll give you $38,500? You know, there's some people who'd say, gee, I've never had $38,500. And I can write as many reports as you want? Oh yes, we'll take one report a day. You know, this is the problem with paying for information. I once talked to a very good friend of mine, who just retired from the CIA operations. Okay, he was responsible for actually defeating terrorism. And he was responsible for all Near East and Middle East intelligence stations. And he says, no, we never pay for information in the beginning. We pay for it in the middle as a control factor to make sure people report on time, give us information on time, but we don't pay for it in the beginning. In the beginning, we get people to give us information for other motivations. They hate their boss, they're patriotic about their country, love America, whatever. Other motivations. The problem with the CIA station in Khartoum, Sudan, is they never developed deep contacts. They never won people over on an ideological basis. They didn't consider America to be an ideological vision, to be something superior. In fact, the station chief, well, I'm not going to name on the air because I think it's wrong to do so, but I know exactly who this man is. I know he went through a very bad divorce. I know he was very desperate for female contact. And he was violating all of the tenets of not just conservative morality, but Islamic morality. And he had made himself vulnerable.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I guess this is Richard Miniter. We're going into, of course, what happened when the station chief, the CIA station chief in Khartoum, had gone through a divorce, was, of course, very vulnerable, was probably seeing some Muslim women, and, of course, he was also supposedly collecting information that was going to be routed back to Langley in the United States, and this information then would become the basis of a so-called a suspected plot to kill the president. So pick up the story from there, Richard.
So I'm not going to tell you who the man is because he was a station chief recently in the CIA. He did retire to Thailand where all his base motivations were gratified. But, you know, look, he then therefore started paying for information and so did his successors. And when you pay for information, you get what you pay for. And so they were told that there was a plot to kill the President of the United States. Now, there were some elements of this plot that were true. The nine Air Force, Sudanese Air Force pilots, the names were actually Air Force pilots. And those nine people were actually trained in Pakistan. And one of them, Mekki Hamid Mekki, had illegally immigrated through fraudulent documents to Greensboro, North Carolina. He was enrolled in the Agricultural and Technical College in North Carolina. He was driving a taxi. Now, he was a trained pilot. According to the source, which the Sudanese had codenamed M, he was plotting to fly a small plane into the White House on the one-year anniversary of September 11th.
But he really wasn't. He was over here just trying to get an education. But
he was trying to lead a decent life.
Right.
Know?
But he had been fingered by the informant, who apparently was a high official and officer in the Sudanese government, who was making a fast buck off the foolish Americans, and he was getting paid for all of these regular reports. So then these reports are getting over here to the United States, and suddenly we find out that Mekki is there in the Carolinas, and he, of course, is a pilot, and suddenly all the red lights go on. There's a plan to kill the president. So then what happens?
Well, then what happens is we finally realize that the CIA's Sudanese source is lying. And the Sudanese decide, hey, the Sudanese, first of all, help us track down Mekki Hamid Mekki in Greensboro, and he's arrested by the FBI. And he's put on trial. He's held in custody in Forsyth County, North Carolina prison. And he's ultimately kicked out of the country on immigration violations. But meanwhile, the source, fraudulent source in Sudan, is brought into the Mukhabarat, that's the Arabic word for external intelligence, headquarters in Sudan, and is set up and is made to take a polygraph, which is administered by the CIA, and has to admit to lying. Now, I know some readers would say, you know, rich minister, shadow war, how can we know this? So I got a copy of the CIA interrogation memo from that polygraph test, and it's reprinted in the back page of the Shadow War, so any reader can read for himself the CIA's own words that their main source in Sudan was a liar.
And of course, really, the twist on this whole thing was that this is an officer in the Sudanese army who's feeding information to the CIA, and why we turned him back to the Sudanese because he lied to us. They probably wouldn't
that's
have
right,
turned him
right.
back if he
and
hadn't
lied. That's why we should always do what sources have lied to us. He was in the midst of building a three-story concrete house for himself in Khartoum, which someone on a colonel's salary could never afford. The CIA should have figured out long before it came to this that the man was a fabricator to enrich himself. He now sits in a British-built Sudanese prison in North Khartoum. But the main thing is this led to a new relationship with the Sudanese, a relationship of trust and solidarity. And thanks to our cooperation with the Sudanese, we carried out 7 covert operations in Somalia against high-value al-Qaeda targets. We've taken these people into custody. So even from the ashes of an intelligence failure, we have reaped a success against al-Qaeda.
And the al-Qaeda is really under
the true nature of the war on terror.
Al-Qaeda is really on the retreat throughout the world, except that they did have a very, very successful bombing in Spain here recently. And, of course, your book takes us right into what really happened in that bombing in Spain and how this whole thing tied together. You actually have translated the book that was written by the wife of the president of Spain, who was deposed to the premier of Spain, who lost the election as a result of the bombing. So do you want to tell that story? Because I think it's a very significant story. It was 2 days before the election is going to be held, or approximately that, when the I don't know how many bombs were, something like 10 bombs go off. I mean, hundreds of Spanish people are killed. Many, many more are wounded. This is a traumatic affair for the Spanish people who've never had multiple bombs attack on their trains before. In fact, no country in the world that I know of has had. How many bombs were they set off spontaneously?
There were 10 bombs on 4 trains right. in Madrid on March 11, 2004. You know, I don't know if you've ever been to the Central Train Station in Madrid. It's a glorious structure. It's one of those fantastic 19th century railroad buildings where the ceiling of the glass atrium of steel and glass soars to 120 feet. And they had 7,000 tropical plants. It's just gorgeous what they had. And it was all destroyed in a blaze of Islamic fury.
Yeah, of course, the problem was that the government initially announced that it was a Basque attack. Now, it was the most logical thing to think that the Basques would have done this because they'd been carrying out terrorist attacks in the past. But, of course, it really wasn't. Apparently, it was al-Qaeda.
Right, that's right. And I reprint Spanish intelligence documents in Chapter 6 of Shadow War, which explain why the government thought that. But also, if you read later in the chapter, what you find out is that the intelligence services were leaking information to the opposition Socialist Party of Spain before the Prime Minister received it, so that the Socialists were able to attack accurately the Prime Minister. And they will say the Prime Minister was lying for information he didn't even have yet.
And, of course, he was getting his information from the very intelligence organizations that were leaking information to his opposition.
That's right. Imagine if in the north of San Diego there's a bomb that go off, and the CIA was to give information to the Kerry campaign before it reached the Oval Office. And then the Kerry campaign was to accuse President Bush of lying about the attack. This is the situation in Spain. It's not a case of the Spanish people appeasing the terrorists. It's a case of perfidy on the part, treachery on the part of Spanish intelligence services if they wanted the Socialist Party to win. And this is what happens when intelligence services become politicized. And Dr. Stan, I've got to tell you something I'm very uncomfortable telling you, but I think I've got to tell you this. The CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, these elements of the FBI are profoundly anti-Bush.
And I was going—I wasn't going to raise that point, but I think you're absolutely right. I think that they—you know—why would they suddenly bring forward one of the experts on who had investigated weapons of mass destruction in 30 days before the election, this upcoming election? He goes forward and testifies before Congress there were no weapons of mass destruction. You know, the Bush administration never would have allowed that information out. It just wasn't politically sound.
Did you notice that John Edwards had the information on the Dulfo report in his debate with Dick Cheney before the report appeared? He said the CIA is about to report. Read the transcript. He says the CIA is about to report. 3 days after the debate, the CIA issues reports to the public. He clearly had inside knowledge.
Well, I've read it.
Why are the intelligence services shouldn't play politics?
And
intelligence services serve the American people and nobody else but the American people. They should not favor one party or the other, no matter who's in power.
I agree with you totally, and there have been a couple of books that have been put out by people working within the intelligence, and, you know, these are very, very revealing books. Why in heaven's name would the intelligence service, the CIA, allow these books to be published, immediately before the election? There's something seriously wrong, and I think you're absolutely right. I think there are people within the intelligence agencies who are intentionally trying to get John Kerry into office.
That's exactly right. I mean, I met a very senior person in Defense Intelligence Agency, I can't say his name on the air, who opened his interview with me because he assumed I was, as a reporter, I was a liberal. He said, I am anti-Bush. And this shocked me. I am anti-Bush. Why are you, as a member of the intelligence service, a senior person, expressing a political opinion? Why do you care who wins? What you should care about is whether America wins. Whether Americans die in the fiery fury of radical.
Well, I think that we're really in trouble as far as our society is concerned today. But the one thing that you bring out so well in your book is that at least there is a coordination as far as tracking down al-Qaeda. And I don't think most people understand really how effective our worldwide terrorist web has been actually tracking down these al-Qaeda leaders and al-Qaeda members.
It's very effective going after these guys, Dr. We've thwarted a lot of plots. We thwarted the plot to blow up the U.S. Embassy in Paris 60 weeks after 9/11. We thwarted the plot to blow up the U.S. Embassy in Bamako, Mali. We thwarted the plot to kill the U.S. ambassador in Singapore. We stopped the plot to destroy U.S. warships off the coast of Spain. We stopped the plot to distribute chemical weapons in the subway systems of Western Europe. We've also stopped a lot in our own country under the raid on the farm in Bly, Oregon, where Al-Qaeda people were training with automatic weapons. Remember the Virginia Jihad Network, who went after people who were using paintball to train for urban combat, where they could have easily, less than 45 minutes drive from the nation's capital, gone to the mall and in front of the Washington Monument gunned people down. We stopped the Dirty Bomber, Jose Padilla, who was going to explode a radioactive device in Chicago. We stopped the Shoe Bomber, Richard Reed, who was going to destroy the flight to Miami. We're stopping a lot of plots. The Bush administration, the American government, has been far, far more active than the media is giving credit for. They're grading on a curve, and the curve is downward. It's a shame. Ideology is the one who lives.
Well, of course, as we look and see what as the story unfolds, now what really puzzles me is why, when we really should have been involved with tracking down Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and al-Zawahiri and Mullah Omar, why we went to war with Iraq when, of course, this was not necessarily a terrorist stronghold. It almost disappears to many people, and this is one of the points, I think, that why some of the people in the intelligence agencies are anti-Bush, is that we went to war with Iraq for reasons that had nothing to do with stopping al-Qaeda. How would you respond to that sort of a question?
Well, that is, and I would begin by reporting the facts.
Right.
These are things that are reported in the United Nations that are well published and well known and well sourced. Now, I have an appendix of this in Shadow War. I lay out the evidence of this. There are three kinds of connections between Iraq and al-Qaeda. There are meetings, there is money, and there's training. Let's start with the meetings. The head of Iraqi intelligence, it's Mukhabarat, flew to Khartoum, Sudan in 1996 to meet with bin Laden. This meeting was photographed. There are numerous other meetings that occurred between high-level intelligence people and high-level al-Qaeda people, high-level Iraqis and high-level al-Qaeda. It's just simply a fact. Let's look at money. Since we've liberated Iraq, we are in charge of Iraqi archives. Going through those records and translating them, we've discovered a string of payments to al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda front groups directly from Saddam Hussein and his minions. Let's look at training. We know since 1997 that a number of al-Qaeda people have trained, not just in Solomon Park, southwest of Baghdad, and other facilities, have trained to commit terrorist acts on Iraqi soil against Americans. In Solomon Park, they practiced hijacking airplanes on a Boeing 707. And they practiced not using guns, not using bombs, but using utensils you normally find on an airplane, exactly the profile of 9/11. So, if you have doubts about the Iraqi war, if you have doubts about the justice of what we're doing there, consider the many connections between Iraq and al-Qaeda, I think, again.
Well, then, but certainly people from Saudi Arabia, many of the leaders of Saudi Arabia, had associations with bin Laden, and there's a great deal to suggest that much of the funding for al-Qaeda came from Saudi Arabia, and 15 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia. If we're going to use the guilt by association, maybe we went to war with the wrong country.
We're not having guilt by association, Dr. Stan. We're talking about operational connections. We're talking about training and poison, training in false identities, and so on. Yes, there is a fair amount of Saudi funding, although that's decreased markedly since 9/11 because we put tremendous pressure on the Saudis. As for the 15 of the 19 Saudis, I'll tell you what, when I was at the Sunday Times in London, I pressured the newspaper to hire a private investigator and look into all 15 of those families. Here's what they said. Not one of them said their son was still alive. They thought all their sons had died in 1985, 1986 in Afghanistan. These appear to be constructed identities. We really don't know who these people were.
Now, what's your suggestion?
The identities of dead Saudis.
And what you're suggesting, then, is that maybe the CIA or the FBI was completely wrong when they gave us the identities. Now, I would tend to agree with you. I think that
Dr. Stan, let me be very clear about this. One of the people who they said was one of the 15 hijackers came forward after 9/11 and said, well, how can you accuse me of hijacking a plane? I'm alive. His passport was stolen at the University of Denver, where he was studying electrical engineering in 1996. That was the same passport that was used by one of the 9/11 hijackers. And he got a replacement passport and went back to Saudi Arabia after he graduated. But these people are using identities, not their own.
And I think you're absolutely right. In fact, Insight magazine carried an article that that at least six of the or seven of the so-called hijackers were alive and well in the Middle East. And if that indeed is true, and I believe it is true, then why is our government trying to convince us that 15 of the 19 were Saudis?
I think the government's pushing the point because we're counting on, the U.S. government's counting on the Saudis being helpful in the war on terror, and they have been sometimes. When they wanted to be helpful, they were extremely helpful. They helped us capture the al-Qaeda admiral. They helped us make a lot of big captures, a guy named Sword, for example. But the Saudis are like the French. They play both sides. Do not put your faith in the Saudis.
war in the France either. Let's go to Herman, who's calling in from Carmel. Hi, Herman. Do you have a quick question?
Yes, I wanted to ask our guest if America is hit with an attack with a nuke or another weapon of mass destruction or biological attack, do you believe that we would retaliate, for example, on Iran or Syria or wherever they might pinpoint it?
Well, first of all, do you think there's a chance of some sort of a major attack on the United States, Richard?
I think there is. I think Homeland Security is very much worried about an attack on the homeland.
All right. If we could track the source of that down to Syria or Iran, wouldn't you anticipate that we would retaliate?
I think President Bush would retaliate. I can't say what Senator Kerry would do.
All right, fine. Is anything else, Herman?
No, just fascinated with the story tonight.
Thank you so very much. Well, we've just got just a moment more, and then we'll let Richard a minute or go. But we got just one small, short segment, and then we'll be done for this evening. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Guest this evening has been Richard Mediter, and his book Shadow War is a book that you'll want to read. It's got fascinating stories in it. Richard walking going out into this sort of no man's land there at Darfur, out in the middle of the desert there, and all literally by himself. In fact, really, I'm surprised that you got out of there alive. Were you?
I was a bit surprised as well. I really got extremely sick, Dr. Stan, and thought I was going to die there. The governor of North Darfur wanted to bring in his personal physician. So it was a pretty dicey situation.
Well, I'm glad you came back safely and that you had an opportunity to write this book, because I think it's a fascinating book. It gives us fascinating, really, overview of America's war on terrorism, which has been incredibly successful. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, the war has been extremely successful. I mean, we are waging this conflict in 102 different countries, relentlessly pursuing the enemies of our country to the ends of the earth. And that's what you want in a president.
And I certainly am very, very pleased that the Al-Qaeda is on the certainly is on the defense. One of the things that disturbs me, though, is that we have never gotten Osama bin Laden, and I think that he should have been the primary thrust. What would your thoughts on that be?
Well, I think he's been a primary target. He's been elusive. Even people who are on the most wanted list by the FBI, the list is posted in the post office in every country, every station in the country. Most of those people are on that list for 7 to 10 years. These are people hiding in our own country. Forget hostile environments and other cultures and other languages. It's hard to get fugitives. But the CIA calls it the problem of one man, how hard it is to get one man. But I think we're working on it. I think we're pretty close. We do get a guy named Mullah Jinan, who is the courier between Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, and bin Laden himself. And if we had broken him sooner, we would have gotten bin Laden. But we're getting closer and closer and closer to Iran.
Well,
it's a matter of time, Dr. Stan.
Do we have any idea where Mullah Omar is?
He's believed to be holed up in the Pasir province of Pakistan. So that's a vast province, and various intelligence leads have led in various directions. And despite the fact intelligence keeps telling me we're getting closer and closer, I got to tell you, Dr. Stan, unbelievable.
Well, I guess you have to be optimistic when your intelligence. Anyway, we're out of time. Richard, thank you so very much for being with us. I know it's late back there. I really appreciate so much you taking the time to be with us.
Dr. Stan, I really appreciate putting on your program for the second time this week, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. You ask some of the smartest questions on radio, I got to say.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
God bless you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Richard Mediter, and certainly one of my favorite guests here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with Richard Mediter. I enjoyed certainly his other interviews we did with him, going into the background of losing bin Laden. And this book is really very, very provocative. A lot of great information you're not going to hear elsewhere. And certainly, I think his overview, we may disagree a little on a few things, but there's a great deal of information here that I got that I had never heard before, and I think his facts are fascinating. fascinating and very, very accurate. So we hope that many of you will want to pursue the book, get the other information. Then, of course, we hope that many of you will ask the serious question, how is it that the bumbling FBI, the CIA that couldn't connect the dots and didn't even know the attack was coming on here, within a month was able to begin identifying these Islamic terrorists throughout the world, and within a relatively short period of time has killed two-thirds of the Al-Qaeda leadership, has tracked them down. We've been listening to their telephone calls. We know what they're doing. How was it we're able to do this so effectively after 9/11 when we had total incompetence, almost keystone cops beforehand? And I would like to suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that we had a very efficient intelligence service, that we knew exactly what was happening beforehand. And to those of you who have not yet seen the video, Jihad in America, need to get that. Now, this book was video was actively suppressed in the United States for many years, from 1994 until 2001-2002. Why? Because it shows FBI footage of the Islamic terrorists in 1988. A man named Abdullah Sam, who formed Al-Qaeda, who led the organization until Osama bin Laden had him killed him. But Abdullah Azam was here in Oklahoma City in 1988 talking about blood running on the streets in America, the jihad that they were planning. There are films of other Islamic Al-Qaeda terrorists in the United States fomenting the Islamic War and collecting funds for it. You will see pictures of the members of the cell that existed in New York City in 1989. Actually practicing with automatic weapons. The FBI is taking pictures of all of this. They knew who these people were, and that New York cell, why one of them killed the Rabbi Kahana. The three or four of them were involved in the first World Trade Center bombing, along with Ramzi Yosef, and the rest of them, along with the Blind Seeth, were involved in the plan to blow up the Harlem Tunnel and the various bridges and sites there in New York City. So they knew who all of these people were beforehand, and they did absolutely nothing about it. They did not track them. They allowed these things to take place. And you have to ask yourself, why? You really need to see the video. It's called Jihad in America, which has been almost impossible to get it, but we finally did get a copy. And they are available through Radio Liberty. If you'd like to give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. After you've seen that video, and if you request it, we'll send you the transcript there free of charge. It's a video, Jihad in America, and if you ask for the transcript, we'll send it free of charge. After you've seen the video and read the transcript, I think you will have serious questions saying, how could it possibly be we did not know this Islamic terrorist attack was coming, especially when on the video they talk about attacking the pillars of America's financial centers. What pillars were they talking about? Well, it's very obvious. They were talking about the World Trade Center. So maybe that's why they suppressed this for such a long period of time. Anyway, of course, we want, of course, to hope many of you will want to come to the meeting we're going to be having on 9/11 right here in the central coast of California all day on, pardon me, this is a meeting that's going to be held on November 6th, Saturday, November 6th. And if you'd like to come, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And that's where, of course, you'll get the video of Jihad in America and the transcript if you'd like it. And then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And, of course, we'll be back in the next hour if you're still listening. Till then, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and hopefully we have with us on the line John Spring. John, are you there?
Yes, I am, Dr.
All right, we're having just a little technical difficulty, and we'll be with you in just a moment here. So you be aware with us, would you?
I'll stand by.
All right. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is John Spring. And John has his own radio program in Southern California. John is a geographer, and he's actually, of course, been studying geopolitics for many, many years, and certainly one of the better informed people that we have here at Radio Liberty. So, John, how is everything going with you?
Well, it's going very well. I'm so excited because this coming Sunday will be the first inaugural attempt to do a simulcast on the Internet with our regular broadcast. And we're going to be on www.crusaderadio.com at 4 p.m. Pacific time. And now we can be heard throughout the nation and possibly throughout the world on the Internet.
Well, I'll tell you, Internet is a wonderful, wonderful means of reaching people. And I know we have listeners throughout the world. I'm sure that you will soon have listeners throughout the world as well. And I believe with the Internet and with shortwave and certainly with talk radio, we have the ability to reach people across America that has never existed, you know, before. So I believe that we can begin to break the media monopoly, these six major corporations that have spent countless billions of dollars building, buying up the various media outlets. And now, of course, we can get around them with a simple Internet uplink. What we need, of course, is to get the American people to start listening, turning off their television sets, turning off most of the major radio programs, the mainline radio programs anyway, and trying to find out what's really going on in the world. So you've had some very, very interesting thoughts on what's transpiring. I'm just going to let you tell us your view on what's going on tonight.
Well, Dr. Stan, there is so much going on throughout the world, throughout the Far East, throughout the Middle East, throughout Africa, throughout Russia, Europe, Latin America, and of course here in the United States with the forthcoming elections. And a lot of these things seemingly are tying in with one another at this time. Earlier this week, I received some information from one of my guests and the author of Dragon in the Dark, D.J. McGuire, and he informed me that another former guest of mine, Gordon Thomas, had written an article in El Mundo, a Spanish periodical, implying that Osama bin Laden is currently in China. And White House intelligence is aware of this situation, and supposedly the Bush administration is hoping to get control of bin Laden just before the election as an October surprise.
Hold that thought here just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is John Spring. And John is suggesting that Gordon Thomas. Now, Gordon Thomas is a very reliable author. He's an Irishman, as I remember. He's written some wonderful, wonderful books, very, very insightful books, has contacts and intelligence throughout the world. According to John, why Gordon Thomas has written an article suggesting that bin Laden, who we just can't seem to find any place, is actually in China. Now, do you think this is true, or do you think that maybe they're feeding Gordon Thomas false information? Because if he does not find him within the next 2 weeks, why, Gordon Thomas is going to look rather foolish.
Well, there are some doubts that I have regarding the information. Gordon Thomas in the past has been one of the most reliable international correspondents that I've ever come across. However, in this particular case, I think he is perhaps being fed some inaccurate information regarding this region of the world, Western China, Pakistan, Kashmir, because he is under the impression, from information that he is probably getting from the Chinese, that the Uyghurs, the people who reside in what is referred to as East Turkestan, or Turkmenistan, is basically an area thriving with terrorists. While in reality, most of these Muslims are very moderate, very tranquil, certainly not even Wahhabists. Needless to say, they're not jihadists. And the Chinese have more or less suggested that if Osama bin Laden were to become a guest in Western China, that he could be there if he could quell the so-called uprisings, which really are not occurring as the Chinese would like us to believe here in the West. So that is somewhat misleading. The other thing that seems to be misleading is that the Uyghurs, the same peaceful, very moderate Muslims, are being accused of being involved in white slavery and drug trafficking. Actually, the drug trafficking occurs much further west in Central Asia, within nations such as Uzbekistan and other republics of the former Soviet Union.
How about Afghanistan?
Well, I'm glad you brought up Afghanistan, because, as you know, currently Afghanistan is producing most of the opium poppies for the world drug market.
Hold that thought. This is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is John Spring, who, of course, is a geographer. We're talking about what's going on. He has simply been quoting Gordon Thomas, who has suggested that Osama bin Laden is hiding in Western China, and that the Chinese, of course, are allowing him to stay there with a proviso that he will then quell some of the unrest in the Muslim colonies or Muslim provinces of China. And of course, according to John Spring, he doesn't really believe there is a great deal of unrest there. And of course, the thought was that, you know, there's a lot of opium and coming out of that area, and John says there's not a lot of opium coming out of that area. And then, of course, we began to talk about what was going on, where the opium is really coming from. It's coming from occupied Afghanistan. Now, the United States controls Afghanistan. We have our troops there all over that country. We have overflights. We have helicopters. We have a large military force. And despite the fact that we have our forces there, we are allowing them to continue growing the opium. Now, supposedly most Americans think there's a war on drugs. And I would like to suggest the war on drugs is as phony as a $3 bill. The CIA has been the greatest proponent or the greatest participant in the opium and heroin trafficking going back well before the Vietnam War. And this is covered in so many books that we cover, books like Drugging America, Defrauding America, both books we carry, the book Into the Buzzsaw, written by Kristen Borgensen, but it has a chapter for Monica Jensen Stevenson, who was married to William Stevenson. And Monica Jensen Stevenson wrote a book that was actively suppressed here in the United States called Kiss the Boys Goodbye. She got the rights to the book, the copyright back, moved up to Canada, gave it to a local publisher there who published the book, but they couldn't let the American people know what was in that book, because it talked about the CIA war on drugs. It was actually a war to promote drugs and to bring them into the United States. So somebody bought up Monica's publisher and accidentally, by mistake, they don't know how it happened, it was a terrible mistake, they shredded 5,000 copies of that book. Now, if you believe that happened by accident, you probably believe in anything. Well, of course, Monica Jensen Stevenson writes a chapter in the book Into the Buzzsaw, which we carry. But you have to, and there's a chapter there by Gary Webb, who wrote articles about the CIA and drugs. We have the Inspector General's report of the CIA talking about the CIA's involvement in drugs. So don't be surprised that we're not trying to take out the poppy fields that are in Afghanistan. Our troops aren't allowed to put this down. And the justification is, oh, well, it's being grown by warlords and we're allied with the drug lords. And we wouldn't want to antagonize those drug lords who are helping us track down Osama bin Laden or do something anyway. So we're just allowing that, but we're really against all that heroin being grown there, all that opium. Well, pick up the story there, please, John.
Well, Dr. Stan, if I may just a moment digress to French Indochina. During the time that the French were still holding on to the northern region of Vietnam, near the border of Laos, at a place called Dien Bien Phu. I don't know if you've heard of this fortress, but this is a fortification just on the border with Laos that the French were occupying. And the news media at that time, mainly French, was saying that the French were so badly outnumbered and the smoke was so intense that it seemed as if the French were losing the battle at that fortification. What was really occurring at that particular time, according to my interview of a foreign French intelligence officer, was that at the nearby Plain des Jars, which means Plain of Jars, they were harvesting the opium poppy, and in the process of harvesting the poppy, they need to cure it to some extent by burning off the outer core of this material. And this was generating all of the smoke that was so intense that the fortification, which the news media misconstrued as implying that the communist forces were basically in control of that region.
But, of course, the question is, who was doing this? Was this the French or was this the communists? I rather think it was the French, wasn't it?
Well, actually, this was being harvested by the Laotians. And they were selling it on the market for the to the highest bidder, whoever that happened to be at the time. And this is well before we ever became involved in Vietnam.
And in the drug trade.
Yes.
Go ahead.
But now going back to Afghanistan, I have interviewed one of the former ministers of commerce, and he said that when they had a constitutional monarchy, some 25 years ago, the entire production of opium in the entire nation of Afghanistan was approximately 12 tons, which was a very small amount, and most of that was being shipped on to the Soviet Union, who was the main consumer of that product, I guess for pharmaceutical goods, supposedly. But currently what has happened, Dr. Stan, is that within various regions of Afghanistan, the warlords, in dealing with Pakistani businessmen, have encouraged the local farmers to plant opium instead of cash crops, which are needed for feeding the population of that nation. And so the people are going on a very marginal diet, which is of little use for daily substance. The irony is, if only the United States would consider an irrigation project for the Helmand Valley, Afghanistan could feed about 25% of its population just from that one region alone, because that's a region where most of the opium poppies are grown, because currently within that area you can only practice dry farming, which means you depend entirely upon rainfall on a happenstance manner, and you cannot grow the cash crops. But with irrigation, in that region would flourish, and the people would have no need to grow the opium. But for some reason, our government is not receptive to the idea of developing an irrigation district within the Helmand Valley. And you never hear any of our officials talking about such a possibility. And yet, that's something that was shared to me by my Afghan friends several years ago.
Well, we could have our helicopters spray the opium. We could stop the crops. We could have our troops burn the crops. We have no intention of stopping the opium trade. And that is the great tragedy as far as I'm concerned. Yes, the people there are impoverished. They're impoverished because we precipitated the Soviet invasion back in 1980. They've been at war for 25 years.
Yes.
They've lost millions of people. Millions of people are living in exile. You know, and every time they start to get stability, it seems that we precipitate another war there. And the people, tragic people, are the victims of a series of wars. Many of them have been run by the CIA, as is the present war in Afghanistan. This is a CIA-controlled war. We have American troops there. But the CIA is working behind the scenes, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And we have special CIA contingents involved in much of the activity that's going on. If the CIA really wanted to get rid of the drugs, they would. I don't think they have an intention of it. I think it's very, very profitable. And they can use that money for their black operations all throughout the world as they replace governments, as they assassinate leaders who do not go along with the plan for the New World Order and the New World Religion.
Yes, and unfortunately, the type of leadership that we are putting into place in both of those nations, Iraq and Afghanistan, is really not what the American people desire or want. It's very misleading. Hamid Karzai is not the kind of person that most Americans would really be proud of. He's very knowledgeable as to what's going on regarding the drug trafficking within Afghanistan, and yet most Americans are completely unaware of his posture on this entire situation.
Well, he was a consultant for UNICAL. He was a consultant for big American oil companies. That's why we put him into power there. And that's, of course, why we really went into the Afghanistan. If we'd wanted to go after Osama bin Laden, we would have gone after Osama bin Laden. Our troops weren't allowed to go after Osama bin Laden until we were several months into the war. And by then, of course, he'd probably taken off and gone to Iran or into China, wherever he's hiding. I don't think he's actually hiding in Tora Bora at all. But they would not allow the American troops to get him. And anybody who doubts that, we have an article out of the Washington Times. Immediately after we started the war, where high officials said, our government is not intending to capture Osama bin Laden first. Our policy is Osama bin Laden last, because if we got Osama bin Laden, how would we justify continuing the war? How would we justify continuing the war? Any of our listeners out there would like to see that Washington Times article, would be glad to get it for them. And I think that's the question that everybody has to ask. Why didn't we try to get Osama bin Laden then? And why aren't we really trying to get Osama bin Laden now?
Yes. Speaking of Osama bin Laden, he has a renal medical problem, or a kidney ailment, which suggests that he should undergo surgery. In fact, he should have undergone surgery in China, in Shanghai, prior to 9/11, but of course, he was preoccupied with other matters preparing for 9/11.
Well, he could even be dead for all we know. All we know is what we read in the newspaper, what our controlled media tells us. Maybe there isn't any Osama bin Laden. I'm not suggesting that's the case, but they can create people. They've created this new terrorist leader in Fallujah. All we know, of course, is what we're told over and over again, and that becomes our reality, sort of like the Truman Show. We'll be right back here in just a moment with John Spring, and of course we'll welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, John Spring. Go ahead, John. Pick up your thoughts on why we're not taking out the heroin crop, the opium crop there in Afghanistan. I mean, it would be such a simple thing to do when you've got helicopters that they can be used for spraying. You've got military that can be used to burn the crops. And we've chosen not to. I guess we just figured it would be too hard on the Afghan people, because how else are they going to make a living? And the tragedy is that these are the victims of the wars that we have created there.
You brought up a very good point. They are the victims of a war that we have basically created for them. They have suffered long enough before our arrival, basically. And strangely enough, and the irony of the whole situation is, American troops are seemingly welcomed over in Afghanistan because they have some hope and trust in the American people, going back to the earlier Afghan war against the Soviets. This is obviously going to change in the very near future if they don't see any significant improvement coming forth for their people. And I just don't know if our armed forces being stretched so thin throughout the world, and our finances are being stretched as well. I don't know if we can provide adequate improvements for the Afghan people in the very near future. I would hope so, but I sort of think that they are being given the short end of the stick, a very low priority in the whole situation.
Well, of course, they had the war with the Soviets. That went from December of 1979 until 1989, and then, of course, we helped to finance the Taliban, and they of course, took over the country, and so that war went on until about 1996, when the Taliban had complete control, and we were financing the Taliban, that we were the largest source of humanitarian aid for the Taliban. And then, of course, we went in and we killed the Taliban after actually having trained many of them in this radical form of Islamic thought. Had we purchased the textbooks, $51 million for textbooks were used in Afghan schools to train the young people in this radical Islamic thought, and many of them joined the Taliban. And then we killed 31,000 of them, actually, in a period of just a few weeks. We only lost 5 men. What a wonderful military victory. But what a great humanitarian tragedy. And now, of course, the American forces are there. The Taliban are reforming. There's violence going on all the time. American boys continue dying. Have you ever noticed that we talk about the 1,000, now about 1,050 American boys have been killed in Iraq?
Iraq, yes.
When was the last time we talked about all the American boys have died in Afghanistan? We've sort of never mentioned that. Isn't that interesting? We never mention all the boys that are dying in Iraq today. Afghanistan today.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Dr. Stan, because so little information is being released as to what is actually occurring within Afghanistan. And I think that's primarily by design, because even today, even though they've supposedly had elections, and with the exception of Hamid Karzai, all of the other candidates have more or less resigned in protest because they were not given the same treatment and privileges and accord as was Hamid Karzai.
And yet we call that democracy. The man we picked up with the election when all the others withdrew.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're talking about Afghanistan, where America, Pickman, our American puppet, Hamid Karzai, won the recent election. Of course, all the other people who were running for the presidency withdrew because they said it was a sham election, because it was a fraudulent election, because they were stuffing the ballot boxes, because there were all sorts of irregularities. But we have said, well, this is democracy, and Karzai won, our man won, and of course, this is democracy in action. And I would say that is democracy in action. If you believe that you can have an election, a fraudulent election, and somehow that legitimizes the government, when we place our puppet in position of power, just as Alawi is our puppet, the Shalabi in Iraq are our puppets, the CIA puppets, the people know that, and of course, who are they going to vote for other than Karzai? Everybody else, of course, was not allowed to run. We wouldn't allow them. That's democracy. Pick up the story there, John.
But what is so tragic about the Karzai regime is that beyond the city limits of Kabul, he has very little control as to what will transpire throughout the rest of the nation. Now, his Minister of Defense, Muhammad Fahim, has actually the ability to exercise much more power with his private army and being able to request U.S. and NATO troops to participate in missions supposedly to fight the Taliban, or are the missions of vengeance to to fight the Mujahideen who fought so bravely against the former Soviets.
Fahim is actually a pro-communist. He was part of the North. He was part of the communist group that backed the Soviets, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was one of their best allies, as was Dostum for quite a while, who's also part of the Northern Front or Northern Alliance. And most Americans do not realize that Ismail Khan, for example, who is the governor of Herat, was so vilified by Dr. Condoleezza Rice when we first began taking control of Afghanistan, because he happened to be in the most strategic location in Afghanistan. That is along the western portion where the proposed pipeline route was to extend through Afghanistan from Central Asia in the north down to Pakistan in the south. And, of course, they wanted to get rid of perhaps our closest, most loyal friend, Ismail Khan, because he was a stumbling block, or looked upon as a stumbling block, to their pipeline route.
Well, that was the thing, and so they vilify them, they demonize them, they do everything they can to overthrow them. And anybody who doesn't want to go along with our policies, they're very, very lucky if they stay alive.
Yes.
Because the CIA does hire assassins. The CIA does have people killed throughout the world. And if you doubt that, you need to read the book. It's called Fixing Intelligence by Lieutenant General William Odom, who for many years headed the NSA, the super secret national security agency. And in his book published in the year 2003, Fixing Intelligence, he can't tell you what's going on because he signed all sorts of security guarantees that he won't reveal what he knows, but he can write a book and ask questions. And the question was, should the CIA be hiring assassins? I think that tells you the whole. The question answers the question for you. Should the CIA, your government, be hiring assassins? Who are they assassinating? They're assassinating people that, of course, don't go along with our policies, who really want to be free, do not want to go into the New World Order, do not want to follow up with the directions that come from Washington, D.C. How can we possibly be a free society here in America when we oppose free societies throughout the rest of the world?
That's a very good point, Dr. Stan. Unfortunately, most Americans who are very fair-minded and believe in fair play and justice, that's the American way, are unaware of the fact that the Brotherhood of Darkness is working throughout the rest of the world and using U.S. policy to more or less establish the so-called New World Order, which actually isn't such a new concept. It goes back to at least the 30s.
I think it goes back about 5,000 years to the time of Nimrod, and where he tried to unite the world. And, of course, God intervened at that time. And there's always been this desire to unite the world ever since then. But only today is there any possibility that this could become a reality as our leaders pursue this goal of a new world order, a new world economic system, a new one world currency, and, of course, a new world religion. We'll be right back with John Spring. And welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. John, please pick up the story from there.
Well, there's a person by the name of Hu Jintao who just happens to be the current dictator of the People's Republic of China. And he came to power after being very successful at putting down and suppressing uprisings in Tibet. And he was the first to praise the regime in Beijing during the Tiananmen Square massacre, on how successful they were at dealing with the students. Of course, more than 30,000 young Chinese were killed throughout various regions of China during that tragic situation. But, of course, that was never brought to the attention of the West.
No, of course. In fact, it was at that point when George Herbert Walker Bush gave a most favored nation treaty status to our good friends in, or to his good friends in Beijing.
Yes. And what we don't understand at this time is that he is perhaps more of a jingoist or hawk than his predecessor. And currently he has control of the People's Liberation Army, which means he basically has the power to call the shots now within China. And it is very possible that he may be able to strike a deal with George Bush regarding Osama bin Laden if Osama bin Laden is a guest within China at this time. And there's a good possibility he might be there, or he could have been frozen several years ago, well, at least a year ago, if he is dead, and thawed out by the end of October, and perhaps a deal will be struck whereby we will allow China to take control of Taiwan without putting up much of a fight. If we do get Osama bin Laden in a surprise just before the election, the Chinese will certainly expect to have something in return, or receive something in return.
Do you think that George Bush would dare do that at this time? Wouldn't everybody say, if we got Osama bin Laden in the next 2 weeks, that it was a wag-the-dog situation that's totally manipulated? Don't you think the American people would be smart enough to see through that?
Well, I think it would probably assure him of being re-elected overwhelmingly, whether that's good or bad at this time compared to presidential candidate Kerry, I don't know. I'm not too fond of either of the major candidates, Dr. Stan.
Hold that thought right there. Well, Dr. Stan back here. John Spring has been talking about the fact that there is information that suggests that Osama bin Laden has been hiding in China and that the Chinese might turn him over to George Bush before the election to actually facilitate George Bush's election. And my comment was, would the American people be that gullible? Would they be that naive if this were to happen just within the last 2 weeks before the election, that they would believe that this wasn't totally contrived, that, of course, if they wanted him, they could have gotten him a long time ago, and this is for political purposes. And John, well, John's thought is that if they suddenly came up with Osama bin Laden, if it didn't ensure George Bush's electoral success, would that be a fair statement, John?
Yes, I think he would probably win by a landslide if they came up with Osama bin Laden and actually extradited him to the United States by the end of this month.
Do you think there's any possibility that will happen? Do you really think that might happen?
There's a remote possibility, although I have my doubts.
The remote possibility, but that seems, I believe a lot of things, but I can't believe that they would try that at this stage. I would think that the American people would say, this is going to be the greatest put on of all time.
Yes. Now, you and I have also analyzed reports that have strongly suggested that during the past previous months, Osama bin Laden had been sighted in Iran.
I think that's probably as much more plausible than he's in China, because we know from the writings of Joseph Badansky, who's director of the Republican Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, and I really believe Badansky gets a lot of his information from the Mossad, and of course Badansky's been writing going back to the late 1990s, the fact that that there was a close working relationship between the Osama bin Laden, between al-Qaeda, who are, of course, they are predominantly Sunnis, and the Shia Muslims in Iraq, in Iran, and I believe that's absolutely true. I believe that they believe your enemy's enemy or my enemy's enemy is my friend, and I believe they're working together because they are joined together in a common religious bond and a common hatred of the United States. So the fact that this has not been brought out to the American people, the fact that Iran has been known to have a number of atomic weapons, at least three or four, for a long period of time, and is quite prepared to use them if they are attacked, the fact that everything now points to the fact that Iran is on the verge of developing the ability to mass produce atomic weapons, and this will become a reality in the next 6 months to a year, and the fact that the United States, and you can go up on Google and check this out, has actually given the Israelis about, I don't know whether it's 500 bunker buster bombs. These are bombs that would be able to take out underground sites, and that's, of course, where Iran is developing their nuclear weapons today. All of these things point to, from as far as I'm concerned, into the very real possibility that we will be at war with Iran within 2 years. What are your thoughts on that, John? And what do you think about these reports that some of it Laden has really been hiding in Iran rather than over in Pakistan, where we're looking for him?
Well, I don't think he was so much hiding in Iran as he was coordinating Al-Qaeda skirmishes into neighboring Iraq against U.S. forces. But I do want to get back to this phenomena of bunker-busting bombs. I don't think we currently have sufficient type of bunker-busting bomb that is going to be adequate to deal with Iran, North Korea, or China, or any other nation in the Middle East, because during the mid-90s, the Chinese, and especially the North Koreans, developed a technology whereby they can dig down, according to Joseph Adamski, to a depth of 2 kilometers, 2,000 meters, which is more than a mile in depth. And I don't think we have weapons currently in our arsenal that can take out bunkers and fortifications which could be producing weapons of mass destruction at that depth beneath the Earth's crust or Earth's surface. So this is one thing that concerns me about candidate Kerry. John Forbes Kerry is a strong advocate, as is Dianne Feinstein, one of the senators from California, against any further research and development of the so-called bunker-busting nuclear weapons, which I think we would very much need if we were to engage in any further warfare, either in the Middle East or in the Far East, heaven forbid.
Well, I fear that we are going to have this military adventurism, whether we want to or not, and I share your thought, heaven forbid, but I think that I have no question in my mind that the war is going to continue. We're building 14 major bases in Iraq. We're building the largest embassy in Iraq anywhere in the world. We have from other sources that they were building massive housing developments in some of the Arab countries over in Qatar or somewhere in that area.
Yes.
And of course this would be then where we would be stationing our troops and their families. We are planning on permanently stationing our troops in the Middle East, which will only inflame the Arab world, and anybody who doubts that that is the real plan needs to go to the website newamericancentury.org, that's newamericancentury.org, and carefully read the report Rebuilding America's Defenses, where they talk about the necessity of permanently stationing American troops in the Middle East. That's the website, newamericancentury.org. The treatise is called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And if you can't find it, why, you can give us a call and we'll get you the exact pages to look on. Permanently stationing American troops in the Middle East.
Well, of course, the reason for relocating other bases is due in part to Saudi Arabia's demand that all U.S. installations must cease to operate within that kingdom, and therefore that's motivated us supposedly to go into neighboring Iraq and other Gulf states for the sole purpose of building bases to replace the ones that we're losing in the near future in Saudi Arabia.
Well, if the Chinese lost their bases in the Panama Canal, how would we feel about if they wanted to build bases in the United States and said, we're going to build bases in the United States, we've got to have bases there to protect China? I think we'd be infuriated, wouldn't we?
Well, of course we would. And the same thing is occurring throughout the Middle East. And unfortunately, we are not sensitive to the needs of the Arab peoples or to the various Muslim factions. We continue on this road of suicide in terms of foreign policy, which is not going to be very productive at all. We might get some oil out of it, but for every barrel of oil, we're going to get several gallons of blood, unfortunately, of our finest young men and women. And that's the whole tragedy of the whole situation.
I agree with you totally, John, and I wish more Americans would understand that. And if we have a successful foreign policy and it's all about oil, why is the price of oil just going through the roof? It seems the more we interfere in the Middle East, the higher the price of oil goes.
Well, in Iraq, there is so much sabotage that is going on that is not reported accurately by the news media. And OPEC still has the ability to set the price of oil with its nations that belong to that organization. And as long as this continues, and the fact that China is also consuming far more quantities of petroleum than in the past, the oil prices are going to continue to spiral upward.
And, of course, when the wicked Saddam Hussein was in power, the oil was $30 to $35 a barrel. And now that the wicked Saddam Hussein is out of power, why oil is pushing $55 a barrel? I'm sure glad we got the wicked Saddam Hussein out of the way. And not that he is, wasn't a wicked man, but everybody's forgotten that he used to work for the CIA, and we have the articles on that. He, of course, was backed by the American government all during the 1980s. Not only that, with massive funding. In fact, I have a book sitting next to me called The Secret History of How the White House Illegally Armed Iraq. And the book is called The Spider's Web by Alan Friedman. We financed Saddam Hussein to the tune of about $10 billion. We gave him those weapons of mass destruction that we're so concerned about. We gave him the wherewithal to build the chemical and biological and nuclear weapons. And now we're saying that wicked Saddam Hussein, why, he even used those against the Iranians and the Kurds. And he did. And he's a very wicked and evil man.
Yes.
But everybody's forgotten that after he had used the weapons, the chemical weapons on the Kurds, the American government continued backing him. George Herbert Walker Bush continued backing him. And in fact, when he was using those weapons, those chemical weapons on the Iranians, I've talked to special forces people who were there helping the Iraqis deploy those chemical weapons, those deadly, illegal chemical weapons. So if Saddam Hussein is such a wicked man, which he is, aren't the people who financed him and helped him equally responsible? And who was the American delegate who was over there talking to Saddam Hussein in 1983?
The same person who gave us aspartame,
right.
Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah, he's the Secretary of Defense today. So, what goes around comes around. And, of course, after doing everything they could to help Saddam Hussein, creating the best enemy money could buy, now, of course, we go to war with Iraq, and now you can see the tragic situation. And they're saying, oh, shucks, we had no idea that after we had won the war, that there would be a terrorist action taken against us. We had no idea why we had promised the members of the Iraqi army. We dropped pamphlets starting back, in the early 1990s saying, when America attacks, you throw down your weapons. Why, we're going to keep the army and you're going to continue having your job. Don't oppose the American army. I mean, you can come in and we're going to keep you in positions. We're going to keep the army intact. Do not fight us. You can trust us. And so the Iraqi soldiers threw down their weapons and didn't fight. And what did we do? We immediately disbanded the Iraqi army. We disbanded the Iraqi police force. We actually tortured to death the head of the Air Force who turned himself in. Many of the Iraqi officers who didn't fight now are imprisoned and have been badly treated. And then we wonder why there's chaos in Iraq. Could you do such a bad job unintentionally? I mean, who did they think was going to police the country when we disbanded the police force? Who did they think that was going to maintain law and order when we disbanded the army? Are the people in Washington, D.C.'s bumbling idiots, or are they truly diabolical?
Yes. Well, according to many of my Arab contacts who are very familiar with Iraq, the situation has gone downhill since American occupation, and the average Iraqi was far better off under Saddam Hussein than they are now. That's the whole tragedy of the entire situation.
I'm sure they didn't like Saddam Hussein.
No.
But there wasn't the mass slaughter that is going on today. Certainly things are pretty good up in Kurdistan, and I think that that's fine. Because, of course, the Kurds want to have their own government. They're glad to be rid of Saddam Hussein. Now, the two forces there, the two major political parties have joined together, and they're going to probably create a stable society. Unless, of course, why we insist on their being ruled over by the Shia Muslims, who, if we do have majority rule there, and the mullahs take over, why we'll have another bloodbath. We'll have a real civil war. Or maybe that's what we intend. Who knows?
Well, I think what we must expect is, as the price of the barrel of oil continues to climb, they're going to say to the American public, well, now we're going to have to invade neighboring Iran because the security for a pipeline through western Iraq, through western Pakistan, through western Afghanistan, is going to be threatened. And we need to get, we need to tap into that Caspian Aral Basin of oil and natural gas so that supposedly we can lessen the cost of oil throughout the world. And since those nations are not members of OPEC, they will say, well, since they're not members of OPEC, we can probably strike a better deal. But what the American people don't realize is the only one that's really benefiting to a large extent besides the Europeans from the Caspian Aral Basin is the People's Republic of China. That pipeline is just about complete and operational, and that's going to be the artery for supplying them with their next need for striking at Taiwan or other areas in South Asia.
Now, John, you're speaking now of a pipeline that's coming from the Caspian Basin over into China. That's what you're speaking of, isn't it?
Correct, yes.
Okay, in fact, this pipeline is going right on through. Who's funding that? Who's paying for that pipeline, do you know?
Well, it so happens that Chevron and British Petroleum and Mobil and most of the transnational and multinational corporations are sponsoring that pipeline.
Isn't that interesting, John, that
yes.
The Chevron and Mobil and these international corporations are funding this ruthless, tyrannical state that where they have more people in prison than any other country in the world, where they kill political prisoners and harvest their organs, where, of course, they repress Christianity, they repress any dissent, the most ruthless tyranny in the world, communist China. Have you ever noticed how nobody ever refers to it as communist China anymore? It's just China. And, of course, who's funding them? Why, Chevron and Mobil. And, of course, their building of the oil pipeline that will allow China to become even more of a military threat to the United States and to Taiwan and to the countries of the Far East. Why would we be creating the best enemy that money could buy?
Because basically we are controlled by powers and a hidden government which controls our government in Washington. And until the American people wake up to that fact, we're going to continue to lose. And it's sort of ironic that when Hu did become the new leader of China, his first visit was to the Caspian Aral region to visit with the leader of Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, because he knows how important that region is for his country, for its economy and for its military. And he will reap the benefits, but at the expense of our transnationals or multinational corporations such as we just alluded to, Chevron, Mobil, and others.
Well, these things are going on in the world, I think, that most people don't understand. But I think that we're preparing for World War III. We're building up the best enemies money could buy. People have forgotten that the terrible Iranian government headed by the mullahs there was brought to power in 1979 with your tax money, when the CIA engineered the overthrow of the Shah and brought the Ayatollah to command into power. But people don't remember that. They don't remember, of course, who it was that financed Hitler before the Second World War in preparation for the for World War II. But those are things that the average individual never thinks about. He just thinks about what he's told by the controlled media. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and this is the last segment of our program this evening. John, what thought, first of all, do you have a website or an email that you'd like to put out for our listeners if they want to get in touch with you?
Well, if they want to get in touch with me through email, they can do so through by my name, John W. Spring, at johnnycosta.com, johnnycosta.com. And, of course, if they want to go to my website, which is worldstrategy.netfirms.com, they can also get an idea of how I analyze phenomena happening in various regions of the world. But most importantly, I would urge everyone, starting this coming Sunday, to listen to me on crusaderadio.com on the Internet, www.crusaderadio.com. And I'm having a fantastic guest on October 31st. He's going to be Dr. Stan Monteith.
Okay. www.crusaderadio.com.
Yes. Well, Dr. Stan, it's a pleasure always to be on your program. I think I learn as much from you as hopefully I share with you.
Well, I learn a great deal from you. I'm always fascinated with your views because you know these people and you've interviewed them, and you have such a great wealth of information to share with us. So now, how can people listen to your program if they're in Southern California?
Well, if they're in Southern California in the Inland Empire, they can pick us up on KSPA, which is 1510 on the AM dial every Sunday at 4 p.m. But I'm encouraging people to try our inaugural attempt at the Internet this coming Sunday on crusaderadio.com.
And what time is that?
4 p.m. Pacific time.
4 p.m. Pacific time, that's crusaderadio.com. And then, of course, if you're in the inland area, what is the numbers there on the dial for your station?
It's 1510 on the AM dial.
Okay, fine. And, of course, you know, this is the first attempt, you know, establish a station, be on that regularly, develop the listening base for the support, and perhaps get a few advertisers. That's how we got started, and I'm just hoping that you'll be able to do the same as we begin reaching out across America, and you continue reaching out across America to let people know the truth. God bless you, John. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
The Lord bless you, Dr. Stan, and thank you for giving me the privilege of being on your program.
It's always a pleasure having you. Good night, John.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, I guess this evening is John Spring, and John always has a fascinating input into what's going on. I think that we are living in terribly dangerous times. I hope that nothing's going to happen before the election. We'll have to wait and see. And after that, well, we'll... Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us as we reach out across America with the information you're not going to get elsewhere. If you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family or know more about our ministry, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you're interested in learning about our Constitution, the foundation of our freedom, we hope that many of you will be interested in attending the last session of the Institute of the Constitution that's being held in Salinas on this Saturday. Why don't you call 877-448-5798? That's 877-448-5798. And, of course, talk to Alex. They're putting on the Institute of the Constitution. They've done this in the past a few weeks. But they'll put them on again if more people are there or willing to learn. If you don't understand the foundations of our freedom, you can't understand how we got to where we are today. And you certainly will never understand how we can reclaim our freedom. Alex has gone to a lot of work to put together the program. Why not call him at 877-448-5798? Alex actually has his own program every Wednesday evening on a station, KNRB, I believe it is, there in the south shore of Monterey Bay. We're on the north shore. He's on the south shore. People all across America, like John Spring, we just talked to, are doing their part in bringing the information out. What are you doing to help us get the information out? So, support Alex. He's doing a great job. Support John. He's doing a good job. And of course, please remember my ministry of Radio Liberty. We hope that many of you will want to support our efforts as well. We, of course, want to remind you that we are going to be having an all-day seminar on the 6th of November at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. That's a Saturday, the 6th of November, and if you can come, it'll start, well, you want to get there at about 8:30 in the morning. The program, you can even get there earlier. We'll open the doors about 8. The program starts at 8:45. It goes through till 5. Lunch will be served, but you're going to have reservations, so give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you would like really to understand what's going on in the Middle East today, you need to watch my video, Iraq, the Untold Story. And then, of course, you need to read the syllabus that goes with that. You can get them separately, but you get the two of them together. There's a very special arrangement, a special discount. But you can't understand anything unless you understand that the war with Iraq had nothing to do with what happened on 9/11. That is the excuse for going to war. But the war was planned long before then. And, of course, we have the material from the Project for the New American Century. You need to read their material. Who are they? 25 people, 17 from the Council on Foreign Relations, 17 to 25, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, Elliot Abrams, Liddy, and, of course, then the propagandists, Gary Bauer, William Bennett, Paul Gaffney, all, of course, working towards this common goal of changing America's policy to create a new international order to benefit our security, our principles, and our profit. Those are their words, not mine. You'll find them on their website. You'll find them in my newsletters. You can read their statement of principles. It's up on their website at newamericancentury.org, 1997, statement of principles. And then read their Rebuilding America's Defenses and find the plan is to permanently station American troops in Iraq and throughout the world. Ladies and gentlemen, we're in real trouble because we've turned our back on God. There are people who want a new world order, a new world economic system, a new world currency, and a new world religion, and the destruction of Christianity as we know it. And, of course, there's no instance in all history where a nation has turned its back on God, and that nation has survived. So pray for America. Pray for revival, because unless there's a revival in America, why we're going to lose this country. And last, please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.